alcoholic. My name's Keith. And by God's grace, Alcoholics Anonymous, rooms full of people like you and a little bit of effort on my own, I haven't had to take a drink or do any dope since May the 11th, 1976. And for that, I'm especially grateful. I want to thank you all for inviting Sue and I here. It's a privilege to be able to participate in your program and your anniversary. And it's a privilege to be able to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's a special treat to be able to spend time with people that we love very much and that we know love us. And it's always a special feeling for Sue and I to go someplace we're welcome. I always enjoy listening to Sue talk. I mean, you can listen to that, I think, if you have any identity at all, whether you're alcoholic or Al-Anon, you can understand why I drank. But by the same token, you understand that there is a true incentive to stay sober there, too, because ever since I've come to Alcoholics Anonymous, there has not been one day, not one day since May the 11th, 1976, that Sue has resented the method of my recovery. She has always supported my sobriety, and I'm extremely grateful for that. And I think that's simply because of the fact that we've never forgotten where we came from. On any given day, our big book tells us in a chapter of the family afterwards, that on any given day, we can sit out and look back on the past, and that we're never to close the door completely on that past. That we learn through the fourth and fifth steps that we are to get rid of the guilt through a process of healing here in this program. But on any given day, no matter what is coming down in our life, we can sit down and we can look back on those experiences and we can draw from that. And no matter what's going on any given day, we can always see a certain amount of gratitude for where we are and where we come from. Now, Sue was talking about newcomers and there's a war on. I say that because alcoholics are so selfish and self-centered that some of us don't know what's going on. But we're very sympathetic and, sensitive and patriotic. And so in California, we have all these protesters against all that stuff. So, the alcoholics I hang around, we're very patriotic, man. And, I mean, we watch the news while we get our garb on and we get ready for it, And I got my little combat hat on and my patriotic tie. And we hang flags, man. And the other day I took two newcomers with me to get the flags to put out. Well, matter of fact, I live in an area where I live in Southern California. Quite a few very wealthy Orientals have moved into there, so I want everybody to know where I stand, by God. So I get these two newcomers. One of them's got the American flag tattooed on his stomach. I mean, he's serious. And this other guy's got one day. And we went down to Toy City, and we got us some flags, man. And we come home, and I had to feed them first. I had to get them something to eat so they wouldn't be irritable, restless, and discontent. Because we had a technical objective. And we get back to the house, get the ladder out and the drill, and we got out in front and got a garage, and I drilled a hole in each end of the garage, and I put a small flag on each end of the garage so it hangs down. So when you come down the street, you can see it. Then I got these two newcomers, steadied the ladder, and I got a half-inch drill, and I went around in front of the front door, over the front door, and I drilled a big hole right up there, and I stuck a big pole with a big American flag right over the front door. And these two newcomers are looking at me, and I got them out in the front yard, man. It's in the middle of the day. All the neighbors around there, and I said, now we're going to say a pledge of allegiance to the flag. And me and this one guy was one day put our hand over our heart, and John, he's got the flag on his stomach, so he's put his hand on his stomach. And we said the pledge of allegiance to the flag. We're ready. We're ready. We don't know what for, but we're ready. And that's the way it is. We have fun around there. We enjoy sobriety, and we enjoy that. And that's part of the thing that, Sue looks at us, she just said, man, I'm glad there ain't no war here. You'd lose. But I'm glad to be here, and I'm very grateful that for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm grateful I'm an alcoholic. I'm grateful that I understand that I'm just an alcoholic. I'm not trying to find out anything else, where I come from. I'm just an alcoholic, and And I come from a long line of alcoholics. I don't know if that necessarily made me an alcoholic. I don't know if I crossed over some invisible line into the throes of alcoholism. It says in the book that we crossed over some invisible line. If I made that trip, I was loaded and I don't remember the journey. My daddy's an alcoholic. He's sober 13 years last August. And as Sue mentioned, Christmas time this year where we all got together. My daddy, 75 years old, and he's a widower, and he came out to California this year and went to some AA meetings with us, and he announced his engagement. He's getting married next weekend. He's six to a lady, 61 years old, and I took him over to the meeting. I hang around a lot of young guys, and I took him over to the meeting and said, "Man, I want you to know how it is in my family. My old man's 75 years old, and it all still works, baby. Let me tell you." I love it. It just, you know, I have a lot of fun today with those kind of things with my dad, and it's a special relationship that he and I have. And those are the things that I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous looking for that. I gave up on anything like that a long time before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the simplicity of this way of life. I suppose the touchstone to progress in a sense of some semblance of honesty. In the beginning of it, that's all I ever wanted my old man to be, just my old man. I just wanted him to be my dad. And my dad's a lawyer. I always needed a lawyer. And so we had some going from the get-go, but, you know, throughout years of drinking, he became anything but my father. My bitter enemy, many, many times. And we couldn't even be in the same room together. Sometimes the hate was just so thick that you could cut it with a knife. It was just sensitive emotions and then anger and rage. And today, through the program, working in his life and working in my life, we can enjoy life together. And he can be in our home. And we can accept him there. And our daughter came home and spent the holidays with us. And I had an experience. I've been on this program a little over 14 years. My daughter's been in Alateen and then into Al-Anon for the same amount of time, within a month or so there. And I've worked my steps. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I owed a lot of amends, and I owed a lot of financial amends. And there wasn't anybody owing me any amends when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. If I had anybody owing me money, I would have got it before I come to AA. And I had nobody owing me any financial amends. And throughout my sobriety, I wasn't much of a person to give anything. I helped some alcoholics along the way, and my sponsors always told me, if you give an alcoholic money, don't expect it back. You have to give it that way with no strings attached. If you get it back, then that's part of the icing on the cake. But if you're going to give money to an alcoholic, sober or drunk, don't expect it back. And, you know, this Christmas, my daughter came home, and through the years, I suppose prior, but I didn't keep much track of what it used to be like as far as money. But in sobriety, there's been times that I've helped my daughter. I didn't do it. I suppose maybe in the very beginning, I'd give her some financial support when she's trying to do something out of guilt. Maybe I tried to buy off some of that, but there's been times over the years that she needed some financial assistance, and I'd give her some money. And I try to look upon that just like I would if I were going to help an alcoholic. If I give her some financial assistance, I'm not going to keep track of it. That was one of my old man kept track of every dime he ever gave me, man. He kept a ledger. And after we both sobered up, I told him, I said, "I'm not going to make amends to you for all that financial amends right away. Matter of fact, I may never make amends. That's my amends." And ultimately, I had to go make those amends to my father. And this year, my daughter came home, and a few days before Christmas, she walked in and she handed me an envelope. And I thought maybe it was some kind of something coming to me. I had my name on it, and I opened that envelope, and there was a card there. And I said, "Anybody can be a father, but not everybody can be a dad." And it had cash in it. Greenback dollars. And it was what she thought that she owed me. It was more than what I thought that she owed me. And, you know, I opened that and I looked at that and I go, my, I mean, the feelings were overwhelming. I don't know how to receive. I mean, I have been taught to just say thank you. But I don't know how to receive. I'm 14 and a half years sober and I don't know how to receive. I'm like, oh yeah, I can help a newcomer. But I'm standing there with my daughter. And what I come to understand at that moment, I don't know. I don't have to know how to receive. All I got to do is stand there and let her give and say thank you. You see, those are the little simple things that I don't know how to do. I don't know what love is. All I knew about love when I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is if you said you'd love me, it just meant I was next. I don't know what the deal is. It's just something you lay on the table and we bargain for it. That's all. That's what you put out first and then it's my hand. Play it any way I want. And I've come to Alcoholics Anonymous and I've come to understand. I've come to understand something about love, little by little. Actually, I've come to understand about love through what it says right up here. Growth through action. And I've come to understand that the only thing I know about love through action. I've come to understand that the first act of love for a guy like me is transparency. I've got to be able to stand in the midst of you and let you see in. Let you see the complete and sum total of me. From the very beginning, from my day one, from the very first day I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, when I walked in the doors and I held my hand up because some guy nudged me, and I said, I'm an alcoholic, my name's Keith. The only reason I said that, because the guy that took me said, when you go in there, they're going to ask for newcomers. And when they ask for newcomers, you state your disease and then your name. Because after you say your disease and say your name, anything else is just circumstantial evidence that you are one. And I said, I'm an alcoholic and my name's Keith. And a guy leaned over and whispered to me, he said, you don't need to say any more. Because that's all you know. And yet, you know, I sat there with the feelings of a newcomer, of all the feelings of inadequacy, of fear, of bewilderment, of terror, all those feelings that I had for many years that I drank behind, and I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and they didn't just go away. I didn't walk into the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous and all of a sudden everything's wonderful. I'd been to Alcoholics Anonymous before. I've been to your meetings. I sat in your little kindergarten chairs in them little stupid church rooms and look at all the crosses on the wall. I prayed your funky prayers. And I listened to your stupid story. And I acted as if until the heat got off and then I went and got drunk. And yet on May the 11th, 1976, I sat in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, probably in one of them stupid little chairs somewhere, and I had all those feelings. And I sit there with all the powerless, no power to do anything in my life, no power to answer any questions. There really wasn't anybody asking me any questions, to tell you the truth. And I sit there with all that inadequate feeling to just be me. And I let you see the sum total of me. A failure. When I was new, I just felt so completely lost, so completely bewildered. And yet the anger inside of me was pushing out through any way I looked at anything was just anger because I was so frustrated. And I let you see that. Where I go to meetings the first 30 days, you have to stand up and say you're a newcomer. And I'm grateful that I had to do that because it allowed me to stand up and be insignificant. To me, I was insignificant. About the time you get 31 days, you become significant and you don't have to say that again. And then you're something. And you can hurry up to be an old timer. But in the very beginning, the love that I got was unconditional love. And I'm grateful that people in Alcoholics Anonymous love me enough to let me be me. They used to have old-timers where I was new that would come up and, and they'd hug you. And they'd put their arms around me, and they'd hug me and hold on to me. God, I hated that. I hated that. Well, God, just hold on to me. I whispered, yes, if you don't let go of me, I'm going to knee you, you old turkey. You know? And they explained to me, you know, some guys, why do they always want to hug me, man? What's the matter with you guys around here? And he said, because when you put your arms around you, it encompasses the spiritual part of this program and God's within, some stupid thing like that I didn't understand. I said, I think you're all fag, tell you the truth. And then he kissed me. And I didn't understand. I mean, they just loved me when I was unlovable. And I let them see that. I remember they had me get a sponsor right off. Matter of fact, they forced me to get a sponsor. Matter of fact, they drew straws. The old-timers drew straws, and this guy lost, and he had to be my sponsor. And he came and told me, he said, I drew straws, and I lost, and I got to be your sponsor. And I didn't really know what a sponsor was. And I told him, I said, well, I guess that means you're going to be my friend. And he says, no, if you want a friend, get a dog. I didn't understand that. I had a 120-pound German shepherd that hated me. And I said, okay. He said, how long did you drink? I said, oh, about 20 years, 22 years. He said, well, you'll have to go to a meeting every day for at least 22 years before you can take a night off and go to a movie. And he said, are you willing to go to a meeting every day for 90 days? And I said, yeah. And he said, I'll take you. And he started taking me to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. He took me home the first time, and I went home, and I knocked at the front door, and Sue and Simone were there, and by that time, I drank all that away. There really wasn't any, I didn't know whether she was my wife, my sister, my crime partner, you know, my bondsman, you know, I didn't know what the heck she was. She was nuts, I knew that, and I went up the door and knocked on the front door, and she came to the front door, and I said, I got to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous every damn day for the rest of my life. What are you going to do? She said, oh, I've been going to Al-Anon, and the kid's been going to Al-Teen, and dog's been going to Al-Dog, and the cat's been going to Al-Cat. Dummy, what are you going to do? And I didn't know what to do. I said, well, I'll call my sponsor. So I went over and called my sponsor, and I said, she's going to all this stuff. He said, don't worry about it. I'll come and get you. And he came and got me, and we started going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I used to sit in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous when I knew and just radiate hate. Just radiate hate. I carried guns. I was scared to death. I had people after me. I had people who was going to kill me, and I owed people money, and I didn't know what the heck was going on, and I just sit in there and radiate hate. And these old guys would say, you're just scared. I remember sitting down on a couch one time next to this old guy. He must have been sober. I don't know. He's so sober longer than dirt, man. I mean, just, and he's talking about God, and I'm just crazy. I just have all these problems going on, all these people money, and they're going to kill me, and I'm just crazy. And I said, are you afraid of dying? He said, no. I just took a .45 out in my boot and stuck it in his chin. I said, how come you're sweating? He moved that gun aside, and he said, come here. And he got up. He took me outside to his car, and he took that gun, and he put it in the car. And he said, you're welcome in a meeting, but your gun ain't. Scared the heck out of me. Scared the heck out of me. I mean, old-timers are weird like that. And I didn't know what to do. I'd sit in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to men's stags when I was new because they talked my native tongue, profanity. And I'd sit in meetings, in stag meetings, and people would talk all this sick, sick, sick stuff. And I'd judge them. I'd think, well, I'm going to kill this one, and then I'm going to kill that one. That one deserves to die. And I think, I think I'll just come back next week and bring a grenade and throw a grenade in there and kill them all. And then they'd stand up and they'd put their arms around me and say, we love you. I said, oh, man, how come you keep doing that? Why keep telling me you love me? I don't understand what that is. And I remember I'd ride to meetings with my sponsor and these people, and they'd start talking about all their, you know, stupid stuff. And they'd say, you ever do anything like that? And I'd say, yeah, I did some stuff like that. And then I'd start telling some of my stuff. And I remember one day it was raining, and I went to see my sponsor, and I was just kind of hanging around, didn't know what to do, and I said, you don't ever want to say this to a sponsor, but I said it. You got to find it out. I said, I don't have nothing to do. He whipped out a matchbook, and he opened that thing up and gave me a pencil, and he says, here, why don't you go do your fourth step? I looked at that matchbook and I thought, that's kind of stupid. I said, that ain't enough paper. He said, oh, yeah, it's plenty. He said, you just put number one up there, that I'm a liar. And he said, put number two, I'm afraid. He said, you can carry it on for that, and then you come back. So I went around the corner, and I wrote some of that stuff, and I come back, and I started telling him a few things about me. And, you know, that was, I remember when I stood there, and I talked to him about some of the things that I was really afraid of. The first time I ever told another human being some of the things that were inside of me. You see, one of the problems when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, for so many years, I had covered up my emotions. You know, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says men and women drink for the effect. The effect is after some amount of consumption, doesn't say how much, but after some amount of consumption, you cannot distinguish the difference between true and false, right or wrong. That's also the definition of a sociopath. What that means is I had no conscience whenever I drank or used. But because I'm an alcoholic, not a sociopath, whenever I sobered up, I knew the difference between right or wrong. And the guilt and remorse, my favorite friends, you know, guilt and remorse, they just reach right in there and go, pull your old heart right out. And then you roll over and you sweat. You know, it wasn't until I'd worked that fourth and fifth step and sat with another guy and listened to him talk to me about how he felt when he did some of those things that I identified that feeling. It wasn't until I listened to you tell me how you felt before I could understand, yeah, that's the way you're supposed to feel. And I remember riding with my sponsor and telling him those things, and he would share his experience with me. Of course, his was always worse than mine. Sponsors are that way, you know. Always got to one-up you. And I thought, man, you're sick. We need to go to more meetings. I remember one time I was riding down the road, and there was four guys in my sponsor's van and me. There was five guys. And I had tried to do the best of my ability to do a fourth and fifth step. And I'd given that to my sponsor a couple of days before that night we were going to a meeting. And there was five of us going down the road, and we started about 6 o'clock that evening in that van, and we'd been laughing and yucking up and telling all them racy stories and all that stuff. And I remember they pulled up in front of my house. They let me out. And they all said, okay, Keith, we'll see you tomorrow, man. We'll go to another meeting. We love you. And they all kind of said that in unison, and they slammed the door on that van, and away they took off. And I stood there in front of my house, and it dawned on me. There was four guys in that van that knew about me. Four people. Four people that knew about me. You know, standing there that night as a cool evening, I kind of broke out in a sweat. Because, I mean, you know, there's some truth in that. They know me. You know, where I come from, being the very best father I could be. You see, my first thought standing in front of that driveway, if you know those things about me, you can hurt me, man. You know I ain't no big deal. You know that I'm weak in a lot of ways. You know I'm inadequate in a lot of ways. And if you want to turn that around and hurt me, you can hurt me. What I didn't realize, because I had no trust when I was new, was that they didn't want to hurt me. You know, one of the amazing things that whenever I first come to Alcoholics Anonymous, I trusted no one. I trusted no one, man. Talk to me about faith. Maybe I can reach and grasp a little bit of something. I can believe my sponsor says he'll come and pick me up. I'll be there, and he'll be there. But trust, I don't know nothing about trust. And the reason I don't know anything about trust is because I'm not trustworthy. Oh, God, I don't like to hear that. I don't even like to know that about me. And if I let you know something about me, my old ways was that I remember one time I was drinking, and I was in one of them places where you ain't got no money. You're kind of on the downside. And I'm in my daughter's bedroom. My daughter's about 11, 12 years old. I'm down on my hands and knees in her bedroom on that carpet, and I just broke her piggy bank. And I'm separating the nickels and dimes and the quarters on that floor, man, because a big spinner like me ain't going to get no pennies in mixed in there when I go down to get that bottle or go to the connections house. I'm going to have silver, baby. It may not be no big money, but I'm going to have jingle jangle silver. And I'm down there shaking that change to get that silver out, and I kind of sensed that there was somebody watching me. You know, when you're in that position in life, that humiliate, pitiful, incomprehensible, humiliating situation, embarrassing situation, when you're a big deal but you're kind of on the floor begging, you sense somebody's watching you. And being the very best father I could be that day, I sensed that that little girl, chin on her chest and her hair in her face, for some reason, I don't know to this day, maybe because she had a black eye, maybe because she had a busted arm, maybe because she was just scared she'd stayed home that day from school. And being like a wounded animal, she was in that closet all day up until that point in time, 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And I'm down on that floor and I'm shaking that chain. And being the very best father I could be, I give that kid a break that day. I give her a break. I let her scoot out behind me. I let her shoot out of the corner of that room into freedom. Because you see, the kind of person I am, if you catch me in that embarrassing situation, it is absolutely necessary. It is absolutely a fact. You can bet on it. I'm going to inflict some kind of a painful memory or a physical act upon you that will supersede what you saw me. It is absolutely necessary, the best of my ability, to either pound some kind of a painful situation in you, verbally tongue lash you, chase you down the street, embarrass you, so that you'll forget, to my thinking, what you saw me doing. And yet, standing in that driveway that night, when those four guys drove off, I didn't even have that thought that I got to do anything like that. Because they knew me. They knew the sum total of me. You see, an amazing thing about an alcoholic that I've come to understand, the minute you walk into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and you hold your hand up or identify yourself as an alcoholic, I know everything there is to know about you. I've either done it or thought about doing it. And I felt just as guilty for thinking of it as I ever did for doing it. And standing in that street that night, I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that the act of love that I was experiencing, looking back on that, was the act of transparency. If I let you see in, there's an unbelievable magic. As I let you see in, the healing process is that I can see out. And, you know, I come from the streets. I come from the background where, you know, I lived out on them streets, and I've always had to have them images. I've always had to have them disguises. I've always had to have all those facades around me to cover up the fact that really what I am is a scared little boy that grew up to be a scared little boy. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm sober a little while, and I remember I was sober a little while, and, you know, I didn't know who I was or where I was going. I didn't know if I was Frank or Ernest or walking or riding a bicycle, man. I didn't know where I was going or who was next. And I remember one morning, Saturday morning, I was supposed to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and Sue was talking to her sponsor on the phone. And I went in and I decided, well, I think I'll dress up to go to a meeting. They told me to clean up and show up. And by then, I'd got a little haircut and trimmed my beard. And I went down to, you know, got me a slick suit, you know, and I got me a big iron to drive. And I went out and I put on that suit and got all slicked up and looked in that mirror. I'm trying to practice I love you, but all I could see was some goof looking back at me. And so I waved at me and I went out. And Sue's talking to her sponsor and I said, see you. And I give her a kiss and I went out and backed my big iron down the driveway and went a block down the street, and there's a stop sign down there, and I stopped, and I looked in the rearview mirror, and I said, no, that ain't me. I turned around, and I went back, and I went in. She's still talking to her sponsor, and I went in, took my suit off, and I went in. I think I'll be a cowboy, and I went in, and I put on my boots and my Levi's, and I put on my vest and my big hat, and I went out, and she's still talking to her sponsor, and I said, I kissed her goodbye, and I went out, and I backed my big pickup down the driveway, and I go down the street and pull up that stop sign and look in the mirror, and I thought, no. I don't think I'll be a cowboy today. So I turned around and I went back and pulled up in the driveway and she's still talking to her sponsor and I went in and I said, I think I'll be a motorcycle guy today. You know, so I go in and I put on my leathers, man, and my bandana and I got my gear on and I was bad, you know, and I go out and I kiss her goodbye, I go out and get the big Harley, fire that baby up, rack the pipes and down the street to the stop sign and look in the mirror and it's shaking. I'm like, no, I don't think I want to be a Harley guy today. So I turned around, went back, put her in the garage, went back in. I took my leathers off, put on a jogging suit, and I went out. She's still talking to her sponsor. And I kissed her goodbye, and I jogged to the meeting. It was kind of new. Sue's sponsor said, "How many people live in that house?" I said, "Oh, just one. The Alky don't know who the hell he is today." I didn't, man. I could have posed for a family portrait by myself. I got it narrowed down to about three. I didn't know where I was going. I was trying to work the steps. I didn't know what to do with those things. I knew my life was unmanageable. I was reasonably certain about that. I knew if you had anything to do with me, your life was probably unmanageable too. And I remember I was sober about a year and a half. I owed all this money. I didn't know what I was trying to run a deal someplace, and I was hung around, you know, all kinds of shady people and everything. So I was trying to cut a deal in the oil business. I went off up in Wyoming, and I was going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous in Evanston, Wyoming. I was going to the Wyoming State Nut Ward. Over in the psycho ward, they had an AA meeting over there. I don't know why they had it. I was the only alcoholic that's sober. Everybody else is over there on Thorazine or something, you know. And they'd come shuffling in there. I'd go read, you know. And I became a spiritual giant over in the Evanston Nut Ward. About a year and a half sober, man. I mean, you can get... I didn't mind telling them people all about me because they didn't remember nothing. Matter of fact, I told a couple of them some pretty raspy stories over there, you know. Blew a little bubble, you know. I became a giant over there, and I come roaring back home down there where we live, and I roared in the house, and I said, "Get in the bedroom. I'm horny. I've been saving myself for you." She looked at me. She'd been going down and on. She looked at me, and she said, "I've done a little sex inventory here, and I've discovered that you ain't made love to me in 10 years. You've raped me on a regular basis." I said, "The hell do you say?" She said, "Yeah, you're sleeping on the couch." I thought, that's a heck of a thing to do to a spiritual giant. I went and laid down on the couch, and we still lived in that crazy neighborhood, and my old hippie neighbors over there, by midnight, while they started mowing their backyard, and Sue's living back there in the back bedroom, you know, and she come running out there on the couch where I was at. She said, "They're out there in the backyard going crazy mowing the backyard." I said, "Hell they are." Jumped straight up off that couch, run down the hallway, grabbed my .44 mag, out the back door, leaned over the fence. That hippie's out there mowing the weeds in his backyard. He's loaded on LSD, kind of doing circles around there, and he made a path back towards me, and I just blowed his lawnmower right in half. His eyes got that big around, man. And Sue ran out there and threw her arms around me and said, "I just love you when you're a hero." Took me in there and throwed one on me, man. And them hippies moved out in a few days, man. I was single-handedly cleaning up a neighborhood that had been corrupt for years. Well, that and the fact that they had one of them, they was muling dope into that house. They had one of them arrows went around on top. When it'd go by a certain place, my TV would kind of go... So I'm sober about a year and a half, and I got my .30-06 out and just shot the arrow off the house. And they moved. I know that sounds crazy, but that's the way I was. I didn't know any different. I didn't know whether, you know, what are you supposed to do? And I remember I was trying. I hear people talk about God. I was 2 years sober. I went crazy. I just went crazy because I was trying to figure out what God's will for me was. You do that about two and a half. I just know God's will. And I just went crazy and I was praying about it. You know, you can pray too much. I just praying so much I was crazy. And I didn't know what was going on. And I went down to Texas and a guy told me, he said, "Did you ever get on your knees, pray?" I said, "No. I never get on my knees unless the guy's got a gun or a knife at the back of my head." He said, "Well, I tell you what. You wear them cowboy boots." He said, "You go back to that motel room tonight and take all your clothes off and you put them boots on. You walk around in there and kind of get right. You go over to the bed, reach down, slip them boots off, get on your knees, and you slide them boots under the bed. While you're down there, give God a little shot. Then hop in bed real quick." He said, "When you get up in the morning, roll right out of that bed, get on your knees, get them boots out from under that bed, give God a little shot, and then call me." He didn't trust me either. So I got out on my knees and I figured, I felt kind of like what I figured a new bride would feel like. You know, here I'm down on my knees, I'm trying to pray, I'm trying to say something. So I figured I ought to make a deal with God. I said, okay, God, I'll never say the big F word ever again. Jumped up in bed and the phone rang and a guy called and he started saying that F word and I started saying it right back, man. Just boom, boom. And I thought, see, I can't bargain. That's the only thing I know how to do. I got to make a bargain or I don't feel like it works. And I called the guy the next morning. I said, I got on my knees, but I don't understand. He said, well, just take the action. Just take the action. Get on your knee. Get in the proper position. And I remember I heard old Chuck Chamberlain. He said, you know, if you do that four step and you do it right, you only got to do it once. And I come to Alcoholics Anonymous and I said, you got to do that four step. And man, I had me a notebook of life, man. I had me stuff I was writing, and I was my own judge, jury, and executioner. I was writing all this stuff down, and then I'd take it and try to share it with somebody, and then I'd remember something I didn't put, and I'd have to go back and tell them. And finally, you know, a guy told me, he said, if you do that thing and do it like the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says it, to do it, you only have to do it once. And I remember I went to a guy, and I tried to tell him about, you know, me, the best of my ability, you know. And I'm grateful that I didn't see the whole sum total of me all at once. You know, for me, it's, you know, I've been revealed to me experientially by, through me taking the actions of sobriety, a little bit of me has been revealed to me. And I remember sitting at a guy's house, and I tried to explain to him, you know, some of the things I had, and he was sharing with me some of these things and about his life. And I remember that, you know, he left and he said, I love you. I don't think any less of you for what you've done. Matter of fact, I love you more. And I went home and, you know, that part in the book, and it says, you know, we're supposed to go home and review ourselves and see if there's anything left undone. You know, I had so much guilt and remorse over the way I'd treated my family. And the way, you know, the awareness that knew I'm right here, I'm with the family, and I'm seeing these things, and they're working a program, and people around me are talking about these things. And yet, you know, I was sitting in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I felt, you know, it's like I sat in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I used to always sit in the back. And it's like I'd hear you talk about good things happening in your life. I heard you talk, and I believed you had good feelings about yourself. I could see it in your eyes, and I could tell, yeah, it probably works. But it's like I got it tattooed across my forehead. You ain't nothing. You're never going to be nothing. You got to stay sober, but this is as good as it's going to get, baby. Just accept it. And I remember looking at that thing that night after I'd tried to share that fifth step, and I remember that I'd taken another human being's life. And I called that guy the next morning. I said, you know, it's an amazing thing. I told you about how I treated my family and where I come from. But I left a very important thing. And I've taken another human being's life. I'm a murderer. And not only that, I never did a day for it. And it was all premeditated. And I got to talk to you. And you know, because of the old timers in this program and the people in Alcoholics Anonymous who love us and who aren't afraid of us, we can't intimidate them. God, I love the old timers because you just can't intimidate them. No matter what you say, they love you because it seems to me like if we're sincere, there seems to be an open hand. And I went back to that guy's house and I explained to him. I explained to him that. And he talked to me about, you know, a life is not my life to take. It's God's life. And I don't understand these things. And that's a part of my story. And my amends has to be handled between me and my God and those involved. And I don't remember exactly what he said, but he allowed me to open that up and see a little bit more about me. And he talked to me about my character defects. And you know, an amazing thing about character defects of my type of an alcoholic, my kind of an alcoholic, a character defect is not a character defect. And it may be driving you nuts, man, but if it ain't bothering me, it ain't a character defect to me. I'll just roll right over you because that's the way I am. And the selfishness and the self-centeredness. You know, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I owed over $250,000. I owed it to people. You don't write them a letter and say, I'll send you $100 a month, Ace. I owed it to people who are going to blow a hole in me if they don't get their money right away.
And I didn't know what to do. I knew one thing. I heard people say, I heard a guy one time in a meeting, and I was sober a little while, I owed $265,000 to these people. And I got to make these amends soon. And I said to them, they said, you'll get your answer in the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. You got to be receptive to what you're looking for. And I said in this meeting, and this guy says, well, I went over to the church. And the brothers and the deacons over the church know I need a little money. So some of the deacons are very wealthy, and they call me in the back room, and they said, we know you need some money. And therefore, we're going to give you this money to go pay this debt. And so they said, you don't ever have to pay this back. I'm sitting at meeting about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm thinking, how much did he get? Where are they? Can I join the church? I'll go. Well, I mean, he was talking about $1,000. But I'm listening to this thing, and I said, when am I going to get mine? I need some money. There wasn't nobody rushed up to me and said, see me after the meeting, I'll take care of it, son. I didn't know what to do. I was certain if I worked, I would never pay that money back in a lifetime. Now, if I stole, I might be able to pay it back. And I'm a good thief, sober. Matter of fact, I'm a better one. You know, and I owed these people some money, and I started trying to make these amends. I didn't know. I got a job and started working. And I'm grateful that Sue, working a program in her life and her you know, particular kind of a program, she never meddled in that. She never meddled in that. Her sponsor told her that that's my amends, that's between me and my sponsor. And I didn't know how to do these things. I remember some people called me up early on in my sobriety, and they told me, how's your daughter doing? I said, she's fine. How does she walk? She walks fine. I'd like to see her have a permanent limp. You know, you talk about prayer. And I know every good thing in my life is preceded by a wall of fear. A wall of fear. And here I'm sober, and I got to Gill and a pass from where I come, and these people are calling their markers. And they asked me to do some things. You know, Sue talked a while ago about the power of the 11th step. You know, I don't understand my character defects in a sense that I can make a list of them from what I learned about me in that 4th and 5th step. And I can come to understand that these things, there are some things that I don't want to give up, and I pray to God for the willingness to be able to give them up. And I can start making these amends in the best way I understand. And I try to make I'm sorries, and I try to, you know, even the score, and I tried to do these things the best of my ability. And I'm grateful for the people in Alcoholics Anonymous that didn't expect me to be perfect. They allowed me the privilege to go through the pain that I had to go through in order to have some value in my own sobriety. Some value for my own sobriety. And because they allowed me the dignity to walk through those pain and those gross things, what I come to understand as a result of those experiences, I have strength today. And I didn't know how to answer all those questions in the very beginning. And I just took the actions. I'm grateful that they took me on 12-step calls. I'm grateful they showed me the basis of this program and a program of how to take the actions to call your sponsor. One of these guys wanted his money, and I decided I'd kill him. I mean, after all, he deserved to die. And I didn't have the money, and I called my sponsor, and I told my sponsor, you know, I think I'll just kill him. He said, well, don't do it right now. Go in the bathroom, write his name on a piece of toilet paper. Matter of fact, write it on 2 or 3 pieces of toilet paper and put it in there and flush it. So I hung up and I went and I wrote his name on a piece of toilet paper and I flushed it. And I went back and I called him up and said, didn't work. He said, pull them little squares out and feel them so that you got 2 squares for every square. And you take and write his social security number on each one of those pieces of paper. And you put it in there and you flush it and then call me back. And I went and wrote all that stuff and I flushed it. And I called him back and I said, it don't work. Still want to kill him. And he said, what time is it? And I said, 7:30. And he says, time to go to a meeting. I'll see you at your meeting. And I went to the meeting. I said, I don't know how I'm going to pay this money back. I can't imagine how I'm going to pay this money back. He said, go home, get on your knees, and ask God to give you the strength to do what you got to do. And, you know, back then and even today, my simplest prayer is, God, give me the signs. You know, every morning when I get up, I say, God, you better take care of me because I'm going to be real busy. And I hit the road. And you know, the amazing thing that I've looked for the road signs. And the next morning after that experience, I went home and I said, God, I don't know what I'm going to do. You got to take care of me. I really, really, really want to kill this sucker. And I went to bed. The next morning I had to leave town, and I didn't, you know, by then things were coming, and I just took off because I was running hard. And I called home a couple of days later, and Sue said, "You got an envelope here. Did you want me to open it?" And I said, "Yeah, I can't come home for a couple of days. What is it?" And she opened an envelope, and I own a little piece of grub property down in Texas that time. Wasn't worth much. You know, just some scrub land. And got it in one of them deals, you know. And in this letter was a contract from Phillips Petroleum Company. And they wanted to run a line across that little piece of land. And they would give me so many dollars per rod to run this pipeline across this piece of land. And it turns out I owed this guy $6,000. And what they would give me to run that pipe across there, if I would sign one piece of paper, was $6,800. And I said, "Is there a phone number there?" And I called. I was in Wyoming or someplace up there. And she said, "Yeah." And I called El Paso, Texas. And I caught a plane the next day and flew to El Paso, Texas and signed that thing. And I got right before Christmas, and this money was due to this guy that I wanted to kill. They gave me a check down there. I went to the bank, and I got a certified check, and I put it in a card, a Christmas card, and I said, "Here's your present. God bless and Merry Christmas." And I took the $800 that I had left, and I flew to Los Angeles. I had Sue meet me at the airport, and I give her the money and went back to work. And you tell me there isn't no God working in my life. You see, those things were taken care of. The amazing thing about that was that I didn't feel like I had been cheated out of that. I felt like the debt had been paid. You see, I didn't understand how God works in my life. I couldn't figure it out. All I did was take the footwork. I tried to make those amends one step at a time. I had to go to a banker. There was a kid that I grew up with. His daddy owned half of the Texas Panhandle out there. And, you know, when we were growing up, little kids, I was a little older than him. And I went down the park one day, and he's jazzing around there, his little knickers, you know, them little rich shits. And me and my gang, the Nasty Club, was down there being our usual self, pumping iron. You know, I was about 8 years old, something like that, you know. Getting our first tattoo, probably. And this little squirt went by, and I jerked his pants down in front of the girl. And my old grandpappy made me go down and apologize the next day because it humiliated that kid, and he cried and he run to his folks. And my old grandpappy had to do business with his daddy. And my grandpappy took me down there and scolded me all the way, and I had to go into that kid and his dad, the banker, and apologize for doing that. I'm 2.5, 3 years sober, man. I need $250,000 now. Quick, the heat's on. And I didn't know anybody was going to give me that money. I played a few of them things, skipping rope around, and it all added up to that. And I called that kid. He was the president of his daddy's bank. And I said, "I need some help." And he'd heard of me. He knew about me. We'd had a couple of crossroad deals down the way. And I flew down to Amarillo and got a car and went on out there in the Panhandle. And the only person I knew that might be able to give me that money was that kid. And I walked into that bank, and I sat in a chair outside his office, and I waited. I'm 36 years old. I'm sober just a little while. And the only person in the world that I know that might be able to give me that kind of money was that kid. And I didn't even know why I had that thought. And I went into that kid's office, and he had one of them big desks. I mean, he got the whole package. He's one of them kids, went to Texas Tech and became famous and got rich, and he's sitting there. And here I am, man. I'm a failure. Everything in my life's a failure. All I got's my sobriety. All the way back, I took a cassette and listened to some old-timer's tape, probably Norm or one of them guys, and I'm listening to that tape, and Chuck, and all the way in that car to that bank and sitting out there, I'm playing that tape. I'm playing. I'm selling my sponsor. He's just saying, "Do the drill, dummy. Just do the drill." And I sat into that kid, and I told him, I said, "You know, I need some big money. I owe some people, and I can't put the money together. I've tried every way." And that kid listened to my story, and he said, "I heard about you. I know all about your deal." Now, the amount of money I needed was just pocket change, that kid. And he said, "I'll give it to you." He reached in his desk and he got a checkbook out like this, and he threw it across to me. He said, "Start writing checks, and when you're through, call me and tell me. And we'll draw up the paperwork." I couldn't believe it. I could not believe it. But then it's real. You know, them things are real. There's one thing about being sober, it's real. And then he looked across that big desk at me and he said, "You remember that day you jerked my pants down the park?" I said, "Yeah. You know, I didn't mean to do that." And he said, "Oh, yeah, you did." He said, "You know, I never forgot that." And he said, "If you miss one payment on this debt, I'll kill you." Now, that will entice you to be true to your payments. But I got the deal. An amazing thing about my kind of an alcoholic, I walked out of that bank with that checkbook, and I thought, I think I'll just go to Borneo and drink near beer. And I went out and I wrote the checks to those people, and I started paying those debts. And I cut the deal, and when I got the deal done, I got a hold of that guy, and I said, "I'm through, and here's what I owe." And he set up a package for me. And I started working the best I could to make that payment, any way I could. But I tried to get honest about it, little by little. And I'd been sober about, I think, almost 9 years. And I was real close to the end payment. And I couldn't make one. And I never forgot what he said. And I called him up. And he said, "What can you do?" I said, "About 100. And he said, "Send it, because that's enough." See, so when they tell you, send what you can and give what you can, that's enough. And I, you know, I ain't going to stand here and tell you I made that debt true blue, because I did some things that I shouldn't do in order to make it. I cut some corners, and they cut off with me later. We know that. We know beyond a shadow of a doubt that we stay sober some period of time. Comes a time when we know beyond a shadow of a doubt we're going to have to make amends for some of the ways we're making amends. But I did the best I could, and I wouldn't look back on it any other way. And I remember I was sober about 9.5 years, and Sue was going to Al-Anon. We're getting along pretty good. Matter of fact, we're doing real good. By the time we were 7, 8, 9 years in the program, we were cutting a real swath around here. I mean, we were big deals in Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon. You get that way at about 5 years. 5 years sober, I sat in my house. Had a big home. Big, big home. Big pool, covered the whole backyard. Had a Mercedes and a Rolls Royce sitting in the driveway. I'm doing good. We move real fast when you cut us loose. I'm rolling. I ain't honest. You see, it's one thing to tell a lie, but it's another thing to live a lie. And said on my 5th birthday, there was 200 or 300 people came to that house that day and sat around that pool and brought their presents and paid homage to me. And had them cards, and we had to sit out there, and my sponsor read them funny cards to me. That was in May, early May, May the 11th, 12th, 13th, right in there. 5 years sober. 45 days later. 45 days later. July the 4th, by that. Sue came over and sat down in that house. Sat on my lap. Put her arm around me and said, "Baby, this is the way it was, it used to be." In just a few days, I'd alienated myself from you. Because the alcoholic ego is an unbelievable thing. An unbelievable thing. Just that quick, I can alienate myself from you. And yet, you know, I don't bother me. I don't even see it in myself. I'm so grateful for sponsorship because they kept me involved in things. They kept me involved in service. And I stayed involved with service. And like I say, by the time I was 9, 9.5 years sober, Sue and we're big deals. I got those reference points. I know how I can blow myself right out of here. 9 years sober, I sponsored over 60 guys. I've been chairman of the Southern California Convention, the largest annual convention in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had 300 people on the committee. I had people coming to me and saying, "If you don't give me a commitment, I'm going to get drunk." Can you imagine the power of that? Jesus! Loved it. I got served with some papers. See, some people were really interested in the way I was living. They didn't care about my A resume. They wanted to know me. They wanted to know about the way I was living and the way I was cutting corners and who I was associating with out there in the real world. 9.5 years sober. My whole world stopped. because I was living a lie. Well, I could come to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and I could tell you how great it was, and I could walk the walk and talk the talk, and I could tell you how to work your steps, preaching around here, telling you how you got to do this and how you got to do it. I could get all these goofs in my Rolls Royce and ride around like one of them guys down in Arkansas. I'd see one got his coon dogs hanging out every window. Man, I had newcomers everywhere in my Rolls Royce. They loved to go with me. I always bought them dinner. Hell, Big Daddy always got the money. It's all blood money, but I didn't quit doing those things just because I'm still cutting a deal. 9.5 years sober, I'd like to tell you, one morning I got up and said, this is enough, and that ain't the way it happened. 9.5 years sober, I got up and my ass fell off. They served me with papers, and they wanted to talk to me. A federal grand jury wanted to talk to me about me, and what they wanted to talk to me about is being involved with organized crime for the last 20 years of my life. Well, I can come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I can tell you a part about me, and I'll reveal myself to me, and we'll talk love, and I'll let you see. But don't talk to me about what I'm doing when I leave the meeting. I'll let you see. I'll test the water. We'll talk about trust. We'll talk about trust a little bit here. And I'll talk to a sponsor. I had a sponsor by then moving right along as sponsors. We find what we want. We find sponsors around here that'll co-sign our shit. I found a sponsor who needed money. I sit in the car with my sponsor, and he's got a briefcase, and I got a briefcase. There's $50,000 cash in each one of them. I just cut a deal for my sponsor because they needed money. And I'm telling my sponsor, if you screw me, I'll have to kill you. And I was pretty certain the minute I said that, I was going to have to get a new sponsor real soon. We suck them into that. You see, there's an amazing thing about sponsorship. You see, if you work this program and you're really trying to be a sponsor, you let somebody know you. The amazing problem with that, or the kind of the character defect with that, is if you're my sponsor and I'm sharing with you and you're sharing with me little by little, if you're being honest and I'm not, I'll find out your character defect. And if I'm not honest with that, I start manipulating you. And then I can do the dance of death. And if you're a sponsor, and that's one of the greatest problems of being a sponsor, is to allow somebody to see all your character defects and having the strength to not let them manipulate you. Or let them try. And I played all those games as long as I could until I couldn't do it anymore. And in 9.5, 10 years sober, I sit in my house and I watch that lady go right back to that insanity. I watch that anger come right back. I watch that little girl sitting there going to Alateen and Al-Anon, and that woman going to 4 or 5 Al-Anon meetings. And my world stopped, man. I'm as close to drinking. Dick and I were talking about it tonight. I happened to be out here for Cornhuskers or something at that time, and I sit in Dick's house over here, and he told me, nice, you're as close to drinking as anybody could ever be. And he was right. There's an elusive thing about time around here. People think just because you got time, you're excluded from being drunk. The power, the ego revives itself, and that just, you get drunk in the head. And I paid all this money back, and I'm moving to a big house on the hill, man. I've got bigger deals coming. I'm rolling right along. And all of a sudden, I find myself, boom, it's all gone. And guys I sponsor are firing me. They're walking away from me, and you want to talk about resentments and hate. After all I've done for you, man, I mean, I held you in your head in my lap when your ass fell off. Now mine's falling off and you're hauling cheeks. Oh, you talk about resentment. You talk about the kind of resentments that get you drunk, baby. That gets you drunk. You see, because I took credit for their sobriety. And I took credit for paying these debts. And I took credit for getting the deal. And I laid the diamonds on her. And I laid the deal on them. And I cut the package. The only problem is I'm 9.5, 10 years sober, and my lawyers tell me, you're going to do 5 years, baby. You're going to do 5 years hard time. I don't want to do 5 years hard time. I don't know if I can do 5 years hard time. I mean, I don't mind doing 30 days, don't you understand? I'll just cut it over here. If I got to do 30 days, I can do 30 days standing on my head. Oh, yeah, no problem. Oh, hey, I do this deal over here. Hey, maybe I get a little embarrassing situation. Maybe I got to do 60 days. I can do 60 days standing on my head, no problem. But I nickel and dime my soul sober. I sold my soul a nickel and a dime at a time, sober. And when it all added up to a big five, I don't have the answer. I don't have the answer, man. And I go to my sponsor. And I remember standing in front of my sponsor 10 years sober, and I got to go stand in front of a judge, and the judge is talking to me about me, and he's got the right guy. I got to sit in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous with guys that I sponsor, that I alluded to the truth, and they walked away. And I got to sit in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous one more time, just like when I was new. One more time, and let you see me hurt, and say, help me. And I remember standing in front of that sponsor, and I thought about the trip that it took from my house to his. It took 20 minutes to get there, and I'm sitting in front of that sponsor's house, and I'm saying, I don't know how to make that trip without stopping and getting some. Because the feelings that rolled through me were just, I drank at a tenth of those emotions. And standing in front of that sponsor that night, I asked him, can you imagine this, a big guy like me? I said, how do you do it, man? And he said, one more time, you just do the drill. You just suit up and show up. You only got to do it one day at a time. You only got to do it right now. Don't answer the questions that aren't asked. You don't have to rationalize or justify your behavior. Sometimes you might, but you don't have to. But most of all, don't let them rob you of your dignity. You know, I had to go through every one of those deals. Every one of those deals, I had to walk through it. And you know what I learned from that? I learned a new way of making amends. You know, there's a different thing than making amends than just saying I'm sorry or cutting a check or laying a fat stack of cash out here. To go to somebody and say I'm wrong. God, I don't want to say I'm wrong. Don't you understand? If I say I'm wrong, I got to change. And I'm afraid of change. Don't you understand? I don't know who I am. I don't know what I'm supposed to be doing. I don't understand this. I got faith that it works for you, but I got no trust. I remember the first time I went and told a guy that believed in me, I'm 10 years sober, I walked up to that guy's house. And I violated that trust because of the stuff that went down. And I walked up to his house to make those amends. And I told him, I said, I'm wrong. I'm wrong for what I've done. I've forsaken you, but I've done the best that I could. I don't blame you, and if there's anything that I hope you don't have to judge other people by my actions. It's been a pleasure knowing you, and I'm glad that you got to be in my life. I've grown as a result of you being in my life. Thank you. And I turned around and shook his hand, and I turned around and went and got my car. And I was two blocks down the street, and there was a stoplight down. I pulled up that stoplight, and a thought came to me. You know, the old me would have been, if I would have had to do anything like that before I came to this program, if I would have had to gone up to anybody and show that kind of amends, I would have had to capped it off with one thing. I may have to say I'm wrong, buddy, but so are you. And I'm going to tell you something. Someday something bad is going to happen to you, and when it does, be damn sure you look over your shoulder because I'm going to be back there. And I was two blocks from that guy's house before that thought even came to my mind. And I thought, my God, I'm going to get to stay sober. I'm going to get to stay sober through this. You know, Sue talked earlier about the simple fact of the 11th step. You know, that 11th step has two parts. Very, very powerful thing. The first part is prayer and meditation. And the second part, when you get the wisdom, when you get the knowledge, you have to have the strength through the power to carry that out. That's what we're talking about here. Growth through action. It comes through the power to take the footstep, the strength to put one foot in front of the other, the dignity to stand there and be yourself, the privilege to work this program and discover something. You know, there's a very important ingredient that I've come to understand. You know, they told me that there's certain actions that I got to do in order to stay sober, and I believed in the very beginning. They told me I had to pray every morning, and I have to give God a certain amount of my time. And I did that through the you know, the little prayer and meditation books they gave me, and I just did the drill. You know, there's some other things that I've done that way through inventory. I've come to understand that You know, I never cheated on my wife unless I was drunk before, during, or after. I mean, that's just it, baby. I knew that. I found that out real early in my... I wasn't much of a womanizer anyway, but, you know, that part of my life, it's simple. And from the very beginning of my sobriety, I've tried to be faithful to my wife. That ain't a big deal. Oh, yeah, after I sober a little while, kind of cleaned up, you know, why a couple of the A girls kind of started noticing me. I kind of thinking maybe they wanted to jump my bones, but it was just because they was trying to be friendly, you know. And I didn't understand what was going on. You go through all those kind of feelings. And I remember one time Sue and I were going through all these feelings. I mean, we go through all these things. We've had to walk back through everything, you know, that went on in our drinking, back through that, all in the bedroom and all those things in sobriety. And, you know, not too long ago it dawned on me, you know, I've been faithful to my wife for over 14 years, since May the 11th, 1976. I've been faithful to my wife. And what that put in that relationship is trust. Trust. Now, that's an ingredient in a relationship that I never had with her or anybody else, because I wasn't trustworthy. And what I've come to understand is, just by doing that drill, by taking the actions one step at a time, I have a trust in my God. Isn't that an amazing thing? By the simple fact that I've been faithful to my God. Maybe it's as small as a mustard seed, but I've been faithful to my God. The same way I've been faithful to my wife. I've been faithful to this program, the best of my ability. I've been willing to change. And what that has given me is a trust. A trust in a power greater than me. Something that I can't see or feel or touch necessarily, but something that I believe in. And what that's given me is the ability to give this thing away. It's given me the ability to have compassion for an alcoholic. It's given me the ability to love my fellow man. It's given me the ability to work productively and live in my community. To have balance in my life is to live in a community where the cops don't come out, there ain't no guns going off. Maybe we get in the front yard and salute the flag, but that's about it, man. And we enjoy life. To have that job to clock in and clock out, to be the best me I could ever be. You know, when I was new in this program around here, maybe, you know, I used to look back on my life, and all my life I wanted to be the meanest man on the face of the earth. I really did. I had all the costumes, I had all the toys, I had all the, you know, the actions and the attitudes to go with that. And I did it the best I could, and that was a failure. You know, today I'm the meanest man on the face of the earth. I really am. I'm that guy. You want to know what the meanest man on the face of the earth looks like? I'm him. You know who he is? He's that little guy who lives down the street. He's got a wife and a kid and a dog and a cat. And he can get up in the morning, he can take a shower and put a clean set of threads on, even underwear maybe. Clean ones. And he can go in the kitchen, put his arm around his wife and say, I love you. And he can walk across that floor and he don't have to kick the dog or the cat. He can put his arm around his kid and he say, I love you. He can go out and get in that car, go down the street, and he don't have to flip the crosswalk lady off on the way to work. He can go to that job and he can clock in and clock out, and he can perform that function by minding his own business and getting that paycheck at the end of the week and put in the back. At the end of the day, I go home, I lay down and take a nap, and I get up and I come to a place like this and I laugh and cry and kiss him goodbye. You know, for a speed freak to take a nap is a spiritual experience. You know, to me, I am that guy today. It don't take much, just every damn thing you got. But you see, I never appreciated anything that was free like that. I never appreciated anything that was easy. I've always appreciated something that I had to work for. I am so grateful that the people who have gone before me gave me the foundation of strong sponsorship, of their willingness to do what I had to do in order to stay sober, of their willingness to change, the willingness to follow direction, the willingness to be teachable. Because what I get to enjoy today is a beautiful life. And I love that lady very much, and we have a good life. We get to enjoy a real good life. Our family's together. What I'm really telling you is I'm current. I'm current. And that's what I always wanted to be. And I got that by coming here with you. God bless and thank you.